Excellencies, I would like to particularly welcome the German ambassador to South Africa, Mr. Freitag, and dear members of Parliament, Envoy Extraordinary Minister Plenipotentiary of South Africa, Horst Brammer, Mr. Kremer, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, today we're meeting at the Haus der Kultur und der Welt to celebrate 20 years of democracy in South Africa, and that's a great honor and privilege for us. I'm saying it's an honor because today we are hosting a lot of protagonists who made a courageous contribution towards overcoming apartheid, and in day-to-day life they help shape democracy in South Africa. And it's also a joy to host this event because it gives us an opportunity to meet again with many scholars and artists with whom we fostered a very productive cooperation for many years, and we look forward to many inspiring new encounters. In 1996, Nelson Mandela was on this very stage. The president who spent 27 years in jail and who had just been released only 6 years came to the Haus der Kultur und der Welt in order to inaugurate the first exhibition of contemporary South African artists in Europe. The encounter with Nelson Mandela really made many decision makers in Germany, be it from the economy, from the business sector, or the political arena, to become involved and help in support of the young democracy, because Nelson Mandela epitomized by his activities in his life something that's very important. It was a message he conveyed at any encounter, i.e. that it is wrong that there is just one world and that there is no alternative. Quite on the contrary, we as human beings have what it takes in order to shape a common world. And we all share one desire, i.e. want to be respected and recognized in our human dignity. So this is the principle of universal equality. And Mandela, in the endless years of his incarceration, came to the firm conviction that reconciliation was indispensable in order to shape a new and joint future in South Africa, a future where the former disenfranchised could reobtain their freedom and dignity. The unfair regime of the apartheid had implemented segregation in all walks of life and aspects of life, and it had robbed the black population of all basic rights. South Africa, in its 2 years of democracy, was able to overcome and dismantle the legal infrastructure underpinning apartheid. As of 1994, no area of public life was untouched by the reforms. South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Committee is regarded as a role model for coping with the fallout of human rights violations across the globe. 20 years after the first elections and despite the achievements of the transition, however, more and more South Africans voice their disenchantment. The project Democracy is facing challenges in South Africa, challenges which result from social inequity, political standstill, comprehensive violence, and lasting social intolerance. The political scientist Agile Mbembe, and by the way, he is also a member of the advisory board of the Haus der Kultur und der Welt, and he asked us to face the alternative. So the challenges could either make us lose hope and just fail, or we could try to continue the tradition of hope and a democratic transition. And we want to continue the tradition of hope. With his keynote, the publisher Njabulo Nebele wants to inaugurate this pioneering working through afterwards. We will be hearing the legendary jazz musician Hugh Masekela. In 1987, he composed the famous hymn which for the freedom of Mandela. Herr Masekela, very warm welcome to the Haus der Kultur und der Welt, House of World Cultures. And tomorrow, at the symposium, South Africa, Challenges and Promises of Democracy, players from the economic sector, education, the legal sector, and the cultural arena will work through and take a critical stock-taking exercise of the various developments which have occurred since 1994. What are the opportunities? What are the possibilities of rekindling South Africa's former potential in terms of hope? Antje Krog's lyrics will then provide a platform for South Africa's polyphonic spree. And then we will have a film program and discussions with the present directors, Carlo Matabane, Jehan El-Tahari, Rehat Desai, and Pierre-Marie. And they will continue the critical review in moving motion pictures. Tabun Dimdi, in his documentary installation, focuses on the various stories of South Africans' exilience. And Jensia provides us with an opportunity to listen in on Afro-electro dance. So this would have not been possible without all the sponsors and the contribution. And our special gratitude goes out to the Embassy of the Republic of South Africa for their their trust, confidence, and their precious support. And also our special thank also goes out to the Foreign Office, which made this project possible with special grants in aid. So I would like to express our heartfelt gratitude at this point. Safri should receive our gratitude for the South African initiative of the German economy, and we would like to express our gratitude for their generous support, as well as South African Airlines and South African brand and Babylon Store. I would also, our special thanks also goes out to our guests from Safri, who were prepare to embrace to follow our visitation. As a democracy case study, South Africa also provides us with a way of dealing and getting an insight into the promises and challenges of democratic societies nowadays across the globe. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the evening.
Dear Minister of State Burma, dear Mr. Kreber, dear friends of South Africa, it is wonderful to see you all here and to know that you are here because you have a keen interest in our country. On behalf of Ambassador Stofile, who unfortunately cannot be here today because he had to travel to Pretoria to attend an important Heads of Mission conference, let me express my profound thanks and appreciation and gratitude to the Haus der Kultur der Welt, der Kulturen der Welt, and the Auswärtiges Amt, and to all those who have made this festival possible. Your generosity and support reflect the warm relations that exist between South Africa and Germany. Ladies and gentlemen, 4 years ago, the South African Embassy already had a very successful cooperation with the Haus der Kulturen der Welt. When all eyes were set on South Africa, it was the FIFA Football World Cup, the first of its kind on the African continent. And now, in 2014, I know there was another World Cup, and we also know who won that one. But now, in 2014, many eyes are set once more on South Africa, because we celebrate another milestone in history. The pulsating rhythms and vibrancy from South Africa's 20 years of freedom and democracy. In 1994, South Africa cast aside centuries of discrimination and oppression to form a new society built on the foundation of freedom and democracy and human respect. It introduced a new constitutional order wherein all South Africans work towards a united, non-discriminatory, democratic, and prosperous society. People from all countries were to be inspired by the overpowering ability of the human spirit to prevail over evil as they saw a phoenix arising from the political and moral ashes of Pretoria. And thus, in 1994, South Africa became the epicenter of the power of peace and an example to a world tormented by division. And for a short while, that bright flame of love and reconciliation took hold of every soul inhabiting the earth. And everyone assumed a new South African identity and became citizens of Mzansi. However, in 1994, when our journey with this young democratic country started, until today, and especially today, we constantly need to assess our progress to peace critically and honestly, lest we revert to the evils of the past by way of complacency. This festival, with its diverse and amazing program, is one such attempt to make sure we do not get complacent or simply pat ourselves on the shoulders. Protagonists from the anti-apartheid movement, like the musician Hugh Masekela, scholar and writer Professor Njabulo Ndebele, and many others will meet representatives of the new generation, like the filmmaker Carlo Matabane, scholar Phumla Gqola, or political economist Mzukizi Qobo, to discuss successes of the move to democracy after nearly 400 years of oppression, when untold pain was suffered, many lives were lost, and much sacrifice was made to get us to the long lines that snaked their ways to polling booths 20 years ago, which in turn heralded a new age of freedom. But we know about the challenges that South Africa, our leaders, and our society are facing today and in the future, and here and now we have a forum to discuss them and to learn from the past and to look into the future. In just 20 years, South Africa's international relations were set on a new trajectory from exclusion and isolation towards global inclusion and cooperation. Our country is no longer a pariah state, but a valued and respected member of the international community. And we have made many friends throughout the world, including Germany. There are political partnerships between South Africa and Germany, like the Binational Commission, which was established in 1994 between Nelson Mandela and Helmut Kohl, and it has been very active in the past 20 years. There are partnerships between cities and also between Bundesländer and provinces of our two countries. And then there are many German NGOs and private projects. Some are old friends from the anti-apartheid movement, some are new friends, and all of them are critically engaging our respective societies through public and private projects which are not often highlighted enough. We salute our leaders like the late Nelson Mandela, who remain a reminder of the people and society we should continue to strive to become. Let us never be unmindful of the terrible past from which we come. That memory, not as a means to keep us shackled to the past as a backward-looking perpetuation of division and hatred, but rather as a joyous reminder of how far we have come, how much we have achieved, and also how much still needs to be done to maintain and sustain this journey of hope. The memory of a history of division and hate, injustice and suffering, inhumanity of person against person, should inspire us, particularly in the world of today, to celebrate our own demonstration of the capacity of human beings to progress, to go forward, to improve, and to do better. Thank you very much.
Professor Scherer, Member of Parliament, my colleague Freitag, Mrs. Freitag, Envoy Brammer. I would also like to welcome the German Ambassador to South Africa, Mr. Freitag. And last but not least, Mr. Kremer. Dear guests from South Africa, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and privilege to address you at the beginning of this conference dealing with 20 years of democracy in South Africa at the House of the Cultures of the World to deliver this keynote. or welcome address, sorry. And I would also like to extend the heartfelt wishes of the Federal Foreign Minister, Franz-Walter Steinmeier. He would have loved to join you tonight, but you, as you may well imagine, we're living in a day and age where there's a lot of turmoil, there's a lot of tension, and unfortunately, Walter Steinmeier can't be here with you tonight. But I was glad to stand in for him. If I think back, or if I think about the year 2014, the year in which we are right now, well, we said, well, 2014 is going to be a year of full of anniversaries. We have lots of commemorative procedures. In Germany, we commemorate the First World War, the Second World War as a commemoration. And Mr. Kammer, we also say that we learned our lesson from these painful experiences and going forward, looking into the future. But having said this, there are two anniversaries which are very special this year. And they mark the end of unjust and lasting divisions, social divisions. And these anniversaries, these commemorations, reflect in a multiple manner, which is sometimes not that straightforward, certain interrelations. Because we're in Germany, allow me to start with German. I mean, Germans from the former west and east of our country can recall a day a couple of decades ago when the wall came down between those two parts of our country, not too far away from here. And there's another anniversary, which brings us here. And 20 years ago, not 25 years ago like in Germany, but 20 years ago in South Africa, the apartheid regime, the divisive apartheid regime, came to an end. And with the first democratic elections in 1994, an end of unfathomable injustice ended. Our countries may be geographically remote, distant, but we are tied through history, because the history of one country was often reflected by the history of the other country. German politics vis-a-vis South Africa was marked in a way which sometimes is difficult to comprehend nowadays by the relations between the two German parts. And I would like to gladly recall that in South Africa, in the final years of the fight against apartheid, people said that there is, it would make sense to adopt the Leipzig option. There were major mass rallies, and that was tribute to the Monday demonstrations, which set an end to the German division. All of this will be discussed here in days to come, because embarking upon a joint future also means to take the time, sit down, learn the lessons from the past, and drawing the right conclusions for the future going forward. And it's a great joy to say that tonight, friends meet with friends, and that's an important outlook for our joint future, 25 years and 20 years. So important anniversary. It doesn't sound that far away. First generation of South Africans born in freedom has only just come of age. But if you think back, and if you speak to young people, if you talk to them about South African apartheid, if you talk to them about the inner German division, then that time suddenly becomes like a completely different era, a completely different millennium. And it's very important to kind of rekindle it again and to fill it with life. Because nowadays we're living in a different era, a different epoch, potentially also in a different paradigm. And therefore it's very important to understand where you're coming from. And a lot has happened since then. The new South Africa found its rightful place in this world. So the boundaries between the different colors of the skin became permeable, an influential middle class emerged, and we had new general elections and free elections in South Africa, the fourth for the first time this year. For many countries, it became South Africa became a role model for realizing democracy, ensuring social inclusion, and ensuring economic prosperity. Having said this, it's never the end of the story. It's always an uphill struggle. It's always a work in progress. And of course, social discrimination will not be forgotten just overnight. Many of the people who lost their were disenfranchised during the time of apartheid still live in dire poverty. We know that violence and crime is a problem and that there are still prejudices and biases in the various population groups. But still, we have a hope and it's a task and we must never relent here, because our task is to make sure that each generation grows closer together. And that is a joint task which we will have to resolve with upcoming generations. Embark upon that road jointly. So, what are the prerequisites for this? Sound education, good education, this is what I'm firmly convinced, and a school system which is open to children of any extraction or any origin and regardless of the color of their skin. The key, this kind of education is the key to the future and it ensures social advancement. This is what we keep fighting for in Germany, and I am perfectly sure that this is also a big, big issue in South Africa, education. And this is why I am looking at one person who really made a big difference, and he was also amongst our guests here today, Peter Krämer. Allow me to address you personally, because you launched an educational campaign for schools in Africa, and you can also celebrate an anniversary. I was told you can celebrate the 10th anniversary, and you allowed many children and young people. You know, the number is incredible. Did I get you right? 28 million? You paved the way for 28 million youngsters and children. So 28 million students and pupils. That's incredible. Peter Krämer's foundation makes such a huge difference for their future. So this applause was paying tribute and expressing our gratitude, and I'm sure every single one of these children will express its heartfelt thanks to you, because you paved the way for it. And with you, this initiative, you launched 2,400 primary schools in sub-Saharan Africa. So beyond South Africa, and this initiative really convinced Nelson Mandela, and he became a patron of your campaign, Schools for Africa. We all know how important Nelson Mandela was, not only for South Africa, but also well beyond its borders. So in light of that, on this first anniversary of his death, we commemorate him in a very specific way. He has been inscribed into our collective memory. And he is also on the poster for this event. But before I joined you, I went to a Berlin school. Let me tell you this much. And by the way, the name of that school is the Nelson Mandela School. And I met pupils and students who come from lots of different countries across this globe. And for them, it's a no-brainer to coexist peacefully. And these students and pupils do exactly what we want to achieve, a peaceful coexistence. And they implement a positive outlook in life. And they deliberately decided that their school should be named Nelson Mandela, because he's one of the most revered icons of this planet. Now, we're meeting in Europe. And let me just briefly shed light on one of the basic tenets of Europe. We learned, I'll deliberately say we learned. We learned to cope, to put up with diversity. This was not always the case. In the meantime, we've understood that differences do not really provide an obstacle, but that they are an enrichment. And the same applies to any kind of functioning, viable democracy. Because democracy also means allowing differences in opinion, agreeing to disagree. That's what democracy means. And if I think of the call for one man, one vote, then that means that the ballot vote allows you to express your personal opinion. And in a democracy, it's a matter of course that the majority decides, but that you respect the minority opinion and the opinion of people who have a different opinion in the next days in the House of the Culture of the World, which is also put on a byword for this diversity. We will hear a very polyphonic and critical and forward-looking discussion. What 20 years of democracy has achieved in South Africa, and we will be discussing the upcoming potentials here. And I am confident that this kind of discussion is also a democratic event, because discussion, debate, sometimes also heated debate, maybe also controversial debate, is part and parcel of the nature of democracy. But I'm also convinced that this is a festival. It's a celebration for democracy in South Africa, for a victory of justice over injustice. And this is a festival which we will celebrate jointly. This is supposed to inspire us with power for the future. And on this note, I look forward to a lot of food for thought, lively debates, and especially a lively festival and encounter. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Madam Minister of State, Professor Boehmer, ambassadors of the African countries, envoy of the South African Embassy, Dr. Hevrius, it's a great privilege to have you here, Mr. Hevrius.
Who maybe not used to the German language so well, and also in deep respect to my late friend Madiba Nelson Mandela. Ladies and gentlemen, when I was a boy at the age of 6, my father said to me, if you believe in something and if you are right, fight with all your means, with all your muscles, with all your power to realize your dream. And that I got as a message from my beloved father when I was 6. Nelson Mandela said something similar in a more perfect form than my father some years later, and said, it seems to be impossible until it's done. And ladies and gentlemen, we all know that a lot of things are possible where we all, not all, but where the majority thinks it's not possible. You just have to do it. Do it. Don't wait that the others are doing it. We have to do it. We have to change this world. That is so important. Many, many things seems to be impossible, but with strong energy in fighting, you can realize this. That we see not only from Madiba, only in inverted commas, that is shown by the life of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King as well, and some others. Nelson Mandela left the prison on the 11th of February 1990, and I was at the age, at that time, 1990, I was 30, around 30, exactly 29, and I saw a young man leaving a prison. He was already 72 years old, but he looked like 60 or maybe 62, and he was smiling. It was more than smiling. He was englanced by the freedom and by the enthusiasm of the entire, not only South African population, but of the African continent. And that was a victory of the entire peaceful world. And when I spoke to him in the first meeting on the 19th of November in 2004, I asked him, how could you stand the 27 years prison? And he said, because I knew that I was right. And that, except of two countries, the USA and Israel, everybody in the world would support us. These were the only two countries who supported the apartheid regime. Another very important message from Nelson Mandela was the meaning of education. He said, education is the key for the rescue of the African continent. He said, education is the key. And now, ladies and gentlemen, please understand this message for a better world. And we need a better world. It is damn important. So, taking up this message, I have initiated Schools for Africa, together with Nelson Mandela, his foundation, and UNICEF worldwide. And it's not the small but effective Peter Kramer Foundation, it is UNICEF worldwide. Dr. Rios, I'm fully aware of this, who is doing the major job. We were able to collect more than $180 million up to now. We are doing the fundraising in 26 countries. We have built now more than 1,500 schools, and we have improved the education situation of 28 million children. And ladies and gentlemen, let me be a little bit proud of that. Yesterday evening, I heard one of my favorite classical music, which was the fourth part of the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, with a wonderful song which starts at the middle until the end of the Ninth Symphony, the so-called Ode an die Freude, which our famous poet Friedrich Schiller has composed in 1805. And the key sentence of this, these words are, alle Menschen werden Brüder. All human beings become brothers or sisters. I don't care. Nothing else you find in the big books of the religion, like the Bible, or the Quran, or the Declaration of the Human Rights in 1789 in France, or the Declaration of the Human Rights of the United Nations of 1945, the respective agenda in 48. All these books, religions, declarations claim one thing, that humanity is far more important than everything else, even than the law, Völkerrecht, law of the states. Humanity governs everything. In August 2000, the 189 countries of the United Nations promised each other, took the obligation to realize the 8 millennium development goals, to halve the poverty in the world, to bring every child in the world to primary school, to treat women and men equal, to treat boys and girls, or girls and boys, that is the right phrase, equal. And what has happened up to now? Something have improved, but we have to have in mind that 2 billion persons in the world have to live with less than 50 cents, US dollar cents, per day. 2 billion. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a scandal which is not only not acceptable for the state and state governments, it is not acceptable for the humanity, for all of us. It is not acceptable. The world becomes richer, richer, and richer. And what are we doing? What are we achieving? Not enough. At least not enough. We are trying hard. Schools for Africa has managed to achieve that the so-called enrollment rate, or Einschulung auf Deutsch, has increased from one-third on average to now 70%. I think, ladies and gentlemen, that is a start for something more. If we take the sentence of Friedrich Schiller, alle Menschen werden Brüder, all human beings become brothers, we will create a better world, in the sense of Mahatma Gandhi, of Martin Luther King, and Nelson Mandela. We will not only try, we will manage it. I'm deeply persuaded we will do it. We will create a better world. Let us not stop. Nelson Mandela, and these are my last words, and as I'm a friend of Africa, I love, like Nelson Mandela did, singing. So he was very fond of Martin Luther King's song, We Shall Overcome. So I ask now everybody to stand up and sing with me, We Shall Overcome. Everybody knows it. Please, audience, stand up. I will go a little bit away, otherwise you will only hear my voice, which is not my intention. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome some days. And deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome some days. Thank you very much for your attention, and let's work hard, let's realize it.
Now I have the pleasure to welcome Jabulo Nindibele to come on stage. He is a Jabulo Nindibele is a fiction and essay writer, a public commentator, the chancellor of the University of Johannesburg, and a brilliant storyteller. Welcome. Thanks a lot.
Guten Abend to all of you. Thank you. And I can add in a few of our languages, Sanbona, Molweni, Dumelang, Huyenant. I'm a creative writer, so you cannot blame me thinking that all the wonderful speeches that we've heard so far were a way of creating the suspense for this big one. Yeah. I would like to thank Hakavier and the Embassy of the Republic of South Africa for inviting me and my colleagues to be with you this evening, reflecting on the 20th anniversary of the new democracy in South Africa. I also know that there are a lot of South Africans here who live in Germany and have been here for many years. We are delighted to bring South African greetings to you all, and we hope you feel that our presence here gives you more strength. And thank you too to all the Africans who live in Germany. And then to our friends, the Germans who are here in the audience, whose presence they indicate their support for South Africa and for this event. We know that we can still feel in the air the euphoria of happy citizens who have won the Soccer World Cup very much. My speech is called Goodbye Sandton and Hello Soweto. You must be asking yourself when you heard about the title, what it is I could be having up my sleeve with such a title. Well, it is no secret. I wanted you to be asking the questions. And if you consider the distance from Sandton to Soweto, it is nothing compared to the distance between Johannesburg and Berlin. But your impression of this distance between Johannesburg and Berlin might change when you consider that the journey between Sandton and Soweto began in Berlin on the 15th of September, 1884. On that day, we are told, 14 states of some of the great powers of the time, including the United States, met in the grand ballroom of the palace of Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. A 16-foot map, high map of Africa dominated the room in which they met. Part of the spirit of that conference is captured in two clauses of the preamble to its outcomes. The first one I'd like to refer to goes the following. Wishing in the spirit of good and mutual accord to regulate the conditions most favorable to the development of trade and civilization in certain regions of Africa, and to assure all nations the advances of free navigation on the two chief rivers of Africa flowing into the Atlantic Ocean. The second one goes, being desirous on the one hand to obviate the misunderstanding and disputes which might in future arise from new acts of occupation, prise de possession, on the coast of Africa, and concerned at the same time as to the means of furthering the moral and material well-being of the native populations, the journey from Sandton to Soweto had begun. This was the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885. A little before this conference, the wars of conquest in Southern Africa had just about ended decisively with the defeat of the Zulus in April of 1879. At the time of the conference, diamond mining was underway in Kimberley, and gold mining in Johannesburg was about to begin in earnest. Cecil John Rhodes was on his way to leaving his stamp first on the nature of capitalism in Southern Africa, and second, on the shape of the landscape on which it would develop and flourish. The administration of conquest in South Africa would develop and flourish. The administration of conquest then was well underway. The Berlin Conference gave such administration a permissive global character. So, while you ponder in the back of your minds on these weighty facts of history I have just presented before you, I would like you to shift your gaze to a slice of life far less dramatic, but potentially no less important. It comes from in the form of a nine-bedroom residence in the village of Violet Bank in the province of Mpumalanga in South Africa. This building reportedly cost its owner 19 million rands. The house looks so huge and unwieldy in its surroundings that the Johannesburg Sunday Times, which published its picture last 13th of July, observed it could easily be mistaken for a hotel. But it might just carry some significant meaning for the future of South Africa. It may not be as grand as Chancellor Bismarck's palace, but it attracts attention in its nine ensuite bedrooms, each with its own fireplace and chimney. The main bedroom has an office. There are three lounges, two bars, a theater, and an entertainment area suitable for all seasons. There is also a refrigeration room. Now, here is the human imagination at its freest, conjuring into reality the dream house of a 40-year-old Mr. Tshepo Makgabane, who plans to use it for holidays and ultimately for his retirement. Meanwhile, he lives in another mansion in Pretoria with his family and four young children. A board in front of the house bears the words, "Ditamaha Baropodi." They ring like a self-displaying proclamation, a kind of through a clan name. But next to this verbal self-identifier is its visual image. It is the image, according to the Sunday Times, of a drawing of a tiger, which, according to Bedi culture, I quote, is a symbol of strength. It conveys a message of his success. It seems Mr. Makgabane has a lot of money, and a lot of it remains after he has built his mansions. Interestingly, the article attracted two letters to the editor, and I will share them with you. One came from a Mr. Mawale, who, while writing from Johannesburg, originates from the village of Shadale, also in the province of Mpumalanga. This reader is proud of Mr. Makgabane's achievement. He thinks that people like him, who overcame hardships to acquire an education, should not have to build a matchbox when he can afford a mansion of his dreams. We from Bushbucks Ridge, he says, are proud of people like Makgabane. They inspire us. The second letter is even more interesting. It comes from Mrs. Tobega Shangase of Durban. For 3 years, she writes intriguingly, "I lived in a three-bedroom house in the suburbs. I felt at the time the suburbs were the next step for me. When it came to making our dream house a reality, my husband and I explored many options. We soon realized that a dream house in the suburbs came with a huge price tag. We decided to buy land in the township where we grew up and build our dream house there. We were able to build a 7-bedroom house there for a fraction of the price. And living there is far more economical than living in the suburbs would be. For the past 5 years, there has been a huge influx of black people living affluent suburbs such as Westville, Balito, and Umhlanga, and building big houses in the townships. This is not a case of flaunting one's wealth. For many, building in the townships is a smart financial decision. Some of my neighbors have ocean view properties that they got cheap because they were in the township. It's a good thing that there is a return of people to the townships, people who are there to build and not destroy. The township is also a place where dreams are shaped and can be realized. People can be successful and they don't have to run to the suburbs. By living in the townships, we are able to send our children to a private school. We wouldn't be able to do that if we were living in the suburbs. If we want to slaughter a goat or a cow, we don't have to first get written permission from anyone or face fines. In the township, we are able to live and live well. Now, in Mr. Makgabane's is a story of hidden in there, a story of generations of people who traveled far and wide to work in the mines and factories of a consolidated country that came to be called South Africa. At first, they moved out of compulsion, so they were forced. Taxes levied by their new rulers demanded from a mandate that they got from the Berlin Conference transformed them into captured labor. Dispossessed of their conquered territories, they were compelled to work. Others came far beyond the borders of South Africa in a massive movement of people. They built factories, mines, farms, towns, and cities of South Africa. In time, compulsion miraculously transformed into opportunity. Decisions to go in search of work and opportunity began to have personal origins in addition to external pressures. There was a life to lead despite the new conditions. If the dreaming of the dispossessed was forcefully restricted for much of the 20th century, it intensified in the new democracy after 1994. Mr. Makgabane's mention is a factor partly of galloping dreams. Opportunity and money suddenly abounded. Mrs. Shangaza's choice, on the other hand, is more considered and calculated. It is creative, resourceful, and practical. She is a symbol of a strategic and practical imagination. Much of the country that was imagined in the course of a liberation struggle of close to a century has been embodied in the South African Constitution. The question we must now ask is how much of that imagined country has been created, taking into account the imaginative and practical resourcefulness of Mrs. Shangaza's choices. It is more as if the new democracy was catching up rather than creating and adjusting creatively. The messages of creative social adjustment are abundant in townships across the land. They call for a determined and focused political expression. It could be said in this context that the presidencies of Mandela and Mbeki complemented each other in a high-level sort of way. The overarching, transcendent, and evocative evocative presidency of Mandela that prioritized nation building through reconciliation would give way to the hands-on state management of Mbeki. Despite Mandela's broadly transcendent approach, there was also grand sweep of provision. The doors of learning from primary to higher education for millions of South Africans opened wider. So did health facilities, clean drinking water, and better sanitation, and electricity became more universally available, even in informal settlements. Wages went up, and consumer goods of all types of description became a general feature of life. Particularly in the urban air centers of South Africa, in their varied sizes, hundreds of thousands of houses were built to meet a demand that had grown over many, many decades. South Africans could travel more easily throughout the length and breadth of their country for business, leisure, or private obligations of many descriptions. The scale of public social communication rose to unprecedented levels in South Africa as people talked to one another through radio, television, and print media. Facebook and Twitter have added to the crisscrossing of billions of words among people. Freedom of speech in particular, enshrined in the Constitution among other rights, allowed for the flourishing of a robust press that is as vigilant in the new democracy as it was courageous in the dark days of apartheid. The high global regard for South Africa as a model country for peaceful transitions in the face of intractable complications in its history and a vision for its future enshrined in a much admired constitution made for high visibility and impact in the new democracy's international relations. One of the results of those relations is our presence here today. It was a grand moment, but a spectral question rose to the surface. What will it take to sustain all this? Not enough time, I believe, was spent on this question. The speed of delivery was not tested for sustainability and durability. Houses, electrical wires, satellite dishes, and water taps have an immediate visual impact of sweeping presence. Their instant provision almost certainly dependent in the most part on capabilities inherited from the apartheid state itself. The desire to achieve a similar sense of dramatic immediacy in the educational realm, for example, saw some catastrophic mistakes made in the public schooling system. More about this later. But the point is, state capability across the spectrum of national life depends on the education system, which takes many, many years to build, although it can be destroyed very quickly. And it would be hard to reproduce within an immediacy framework. What prompted such discontinuity within the schooling system cannot be dismissed easily. The record of history is very clear that white people in South Africa, through their historic and purposeful dominance of the commanding heights of government, the economy, and the range of cultural institutions, located themselves in domains of the highest value in the national life of the country. Those domains accorded them the autonomy to thrive within them at the same time as they created an entrenched dependence on the part of black people purposefully excluded from them. white laws reduced black people into instruments in a system that needed them to maintain it, even in their required subservience to it. Black people may have resented the situation, as they did, but they nevertheless grew to be dependent on it. Thus, both the white master and the black servant were equally attracted to the highest, where the highest political, economic, legal, and social value at the national scale was to be located. They lived there and worked together more in a state of managed conflict than willing collaboration. It goes without saying that should an opportunity arise, the dispossessed, instrumentalized, and excluded millions will want to seize control of the commanding heights of national life and replace the people who have dominated it to their exclusive benefit for over 100 years of South African capitalism. It is the most natural thing to expect that people so oppressed will react in that particular kind of way. But this seizing control can come with both opportunities and threats. Are the newly enfranchised, now in power, able to find the critical balance between aspiration and the necessary conditions critical to deliver the desires of aspiration? Was the intellectual, political, economic, and cultural self-interest of the new citizens of the Republic as robust, as focused, as principled as the colonial self-interest that dominated them and shaped them for over a century? The strategic gap, then, between aspiration and achievement in the first 5 to 10 years of the new democracy was necessarily narrowed to put a stamp of legitimacy to the state in the transition to democracy. The quickly you act and provide certain things, the more legitimacy you have. But sustaining achievement became much more unpredictable in the second term of President Mbeki, as the opportunities of intervention turned into threats, widening the strategic gap. The levels of unpredictability are critically high in the ongoing tenure of President Zuma. The ability for the 10-year-old democracy to deliver on its promises has become perilously uncertain. One way to understand this is to reflect on how we have, since 1994, dealt with an issue I've reflected upon some 4 years ago that I have called resilient factors that stand in the way of fundamental transformation in the South African state towards a qualitative democracy. Resilient factors I've defined as follows: are conditions that resist change even as they give the appearance of change. Such conditions, the focus of good intentions always, soon undermine the very good intentions through the depth and durability of their embedded effects. Change that is genuinely sought is delayed because the permanent solution is sought is impossible to achieve within a time frame of immediacy, regardless of the justice of the desire for it. In the accumulation of such delays, the sense of transition risks becoming frustratingly permanent because the process towards a desired lasting end is seldom spelled out as a feature of political management. The government's always think that when they promise something, it's going to happen, and then people think it's going to happen because people are not told that some of the things that are promised will actually take a very long time to reach fruition. And this causes problems within the population. The resulting state of inertia may generate its own politics, which may be as vibrant as any, but actually produces the effect of dancing on the same ground, exciting, but of little essence. South Africans will recall that in the first 5 years of democracy, the transformation objective of changing the demographic composition of teachers in the schooling system led to many policies, among them the offering of early retirement packages to teachers. In the main, many of the best left in large numbers. Many of the not so best remained. 15 years later, the public education system, where millions of the poor are educated, stands on its knees. Education as the base for cross-generational reproduction of social capability has yet to support a new democracy for the long run. Then there is the resilience of the inherited apartheid landscape. For a people so extensively traumatized and anguished by settlements created for their dehumanization, the new citizens of South Africa have displayed an exasperating lack of urgency in their commitment to changing these conditions in the townships in radical ways. The townships, already orientated towards an outward reality of service in servitude, remain today dormitory enclaves which still export their energies every day in ways conceived, designed, and carried out for over a century of South African capitalism. Post-apartheid provision of housing has not produced bold models that represent alternative conceptualizations of settlements that answer to the dreams and desires of the dispossessed. The statistically successful provision of houses has not extended the horizons of social imagination. When we built millions of houses, we forgot that we needed to build not so much houses, but to build communities. I have pondered on the state of trade unionism in South Africa as well, as another resilient factor. Since 1973, the trade union movement gave tremendous impetus to the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Its impact has been in the key sectors of the economy: mining, health, manufacturing, education, and transport. It has consolidated itself to take full advantage of the democratic spaces created in a post-apartheid state. But its engagement with the embedded mechanisms of a capitalist state appears to have locked it into a logic of redress and redistribution. In that context, the struggle for higher wages, while understandable, has inadvertently subjugated a larger objective to the wage demand. The wage demand, however understandable, fights the system on its own terms. The wage has become disembodied in the broader lifestyle enhancement sought for the workers and their families in an overarchingly capable state. Marikana demonstrated this horribly. The dormitory townships in which millions of union members live persists. Workers are still alienated from the state in a manner reminiscent of pre-liberation days. The quest for a collective interest to channel diverse loyalties towards a redesigned state is far from over. The state seems unable to manage diverse collective interests towards a coherent and overriding goals of a collective interest. The fundamental goal is universal social enablement, in which the net of opportunity and state support is cast as widely as possible over the ocean of South Africa's human talent. The goal is properly situated in an overarching project of nation building. Perhaps the greatest symbol of embedded resilience is the ultimate achievement of the Berlin Conference on Africa. It is a place that has within it what has been described that is in Africa. It has a place within it that has been described as, quote unquote, the richest square mile in Africa. This place houses the largest stock exchange on the continent, with a market capitalization of $903 billion in 2012. This place is the last home of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange since it moved there in the year 2000 after abandoning the almost decayed central business district of Johannesburg. Of course, the central business district of Johannesburg, let us not forget, was itself the ultimate achievement of the old money of the 19th century gold mining and its landlords. After over a century of accumulated assets and a business culture that reproduced its origins, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange sought a new home and found it, as you will guess, in Sandton. It was a long journey from the establishment of Africa's first stock exchange on the 8th of November in 1887, 2 years after the Berlin Conference. Sandton, attracting immediate attention with its massive modern buildings, it exerts a solid authority of modernity. Mr. Mahabane's mention in Violet Bank in its structural architectural resonance clearly aspires towards some kind of Sandton. But it is now clear that more was needed than evocative aspiration in the desired and necessary replacement of white power by enfranchised citizens. The historical contest between white and black, developed and sustained by whites as a justifying ideology, has increasingly been restored in the new democracy as a primary site on which to place the critique of state capability. This, I believe, is a serious mistake. Race relations may be important in the first 20 years of South Africa's transition to democracy, but it has been, that is, race relations and racism and all those things, a wobbling bamboo bridge. To keep focusing on race relations and their restrictive instruments of affirmative action, economic, black economic empowerment, and the black this and the black that, as various notions of transformation, is to put formalin around social transition and to render permanent the wobbling bamboo bridge. To retain and maintain racism's evocative power as primary to the psychology of transition is to deflect attention from other, perhaps even more fundamental tendencies in South African history. While racial thinking and its various variations have shaped much of South African history, they are not fundamental to its future. What is more fundamental was not created by racial thinking, but that racial think, but what racial thinking was mobilized for. It was mobilized for the growth of Western economies in the 19th and 20th centuries. It was for these economies that mines and factories were established in South Africa. It is the labor for these mines that necessitated the disposition of conquered peoples of their lands, the destruction of their economies, and their massive conscription as labor. What the dispossessed became when they congregated in the mines, factories, and farms of South Africa is a story that is yet to be told and holds the key to the future. When Mrs. Shangase and her family decided to move from their Durban suburb back to their township, they were part of a growing trend. Soweto, the ultimate symbol of the South African township, is starting to take back her children. Sandton, with all its glitter, turned out not to be a home after all. More moving there may have been a part of affirming the constitutional rights of movement and claiming back the land. I will live anywhere I like in this country, is an understandable reaction. But it turns out the suburbs were no home after all. And it makes sense. South African suburbs are a product of a long history of political racism. For the dispossessed let into them, they represent existential discomfort and deep political anxieties. If you were there out of compulsion, you may be there now to make a statement. That statement you learn could never be the sum total of your reason to be. Thank you. Your reason to be took more than a century to establish. Soweto, a sprawling city of approximately 2 million people, is unrecognizable from its origins in 1904, when British-controlled city authorities removed black South Africans and Indian residents of brickfields to an evacuation camp at Klerksdorp Municipal Sewage Farm outside the Johannesburg municipal boundary following a reported outbreak of plague. Now, it is fascinating that people feared to be possible carriers of plague were moved to a sewage farm where the plague was guaranteed to have 5-star hotel conditions to proliferate. 2 further townships were laid out to the east and the west of Johannesburg in 1918. Townships to the southwest of Johannesburg followed, starting with Pimville in 1934 and renamed part of Klerksdorp and Orlando in 1935. And so what came to be Soweto grew into a multi-ethnic melting pot, a congregation of millions of the dispossessed throughout the subcontinent of Southern Africa. Once there, they lived and worked together, and over the decades, they became a different people altogether. They heard new languages and spoke them. They experienced new cultures and lived them. They intermarried. They became the first full-blown working class of Africa, a new people with a vastly expanded awareness far beyond that of their rural origins. They either lived in mine compounds or set up their own houses somewhere. Some among the nascent intelligentsia began to talk about the concept of the new African. They became the first people in Africa to undergo a vast industrial, multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-intellectual adaptation of unprecedented scale. This is the miracle that came along the way of the dispossessed. They found one another there and built social solidarities they had never experienced before and which have grown. What the multi-ethnic founders of the African National Congress hoped for, to unite the dispossessed, came on its own over decades of urban consolidation. As the economy they built and the laws that supported it grew in their power over them, they began to resist its deleterious economic and political effects. Their efforts ultimately led to the democracy that was born on the 27th of April, 1994. Sandton is in Gauteng, the richest province in South Africa and the heartbeat of its economy. Hundreds of thousands from all corners of South Africa and beyond traveled to Johannesburg, a city that fired their imaginations. They called it Egoli, or Gauteng, the city of gold. But the gold reef spread east and west of Johannesburg such that Gauteng became a generalized area beyond its Johannesburg center. Today, it carries the name of an entire province. The naming of this province is a just recognition of a phenomenon that even the Constitution has missed. Section 1B of the founding provisions of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa refers to the two values of non-racialism and non-sexism. The extensive consultation process to put the Constitution together missed out two critical values built over a century of living them in the townships of South Africa: non-ethnicism and multiculturalism. The dominance of race relations in the public imagination today has blocked out the treasure of South African history, a cosmopolitanism that flourished in various ways in the townships. The real strategic alternative to whiteness is not blackness, but multi-ethnic identities in a common constitutional citizenship in which multi-ethnic bonding took place to various degrees in the townships of South Africa. Even if tragedies and triumphs occurred, it was bonding nevertheless. White South Africans, in the main, chose formally to stay out of that historic process. Mostly, they were blissfully unaware of it. Where they saw it, that solidarity, they tried to tear it apart. They are now free to become a part of a greater human solidarity, the township's greatest gift to the people of South Africa and perhaps to the world. Sandton, in its triumph, represents an economy that has been and continues to be in a predatory relationship with the overwhelming bulk of its population. If the primary purpose of an economy is to enhance the welfare of its citizens, then the wealth of South Africa should no longer be exported to the same degree for the continuous enrichment of other countries, regardless of the merits of globalization. If Sandton fundamentally continues to serve that role, if it structurally represents the ultimate purpose in Africa of asset global accumulation and the value accretion in the long journey from Berlin, it cannot be the symbol of success of the South African economy, but its failure. While Sandton cannot be irrelevant to the success of the South African economy, it cannot, in its current orientation, be its defining essence. Its opulent success contains within itself a moral repudiation it has not even begun to address. There are people in South Africa today who have begun to dream of a return to pre-colonial land dispensations. These are dreams too ghastly to contemplate. They will almost certainly tear South Africa apart. The Berlin Conference parcelled out territories in Africa for better or for worse. The unitary image of South Africa as a land mass, internally rearranged since 1994, is fixed in the minds of the overwhelming majority of South Africa's population, whatever their ownership relationship to it. So is its economic landscape and social landscape. We cannot afford to undo the legacy of multi-ethnic and multicultural congregation that continues and which now requires the express attention of a democratic state that has rediscovered a key and necessary foundation for its future. The families, to conclude, the families of Mrs. Shangase and Mr. Makgabane, who have returned to the opportunities they have discovered in their respective formative origins, and join us to take the journey with them, part real, part conceptual, from Sandton to Soweto. They urge us to go along with them into the future. Then perhaps armed with success, we will pass by in that journey in Berlin, where Berliners will have surely agonized over the implications of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, for global peace and welfare. And we will say to them in Berlin, we in South Africa have found new ways to truly humanize capitalism and perhaps avoid the next global wars. We have reconceptualized and restructured South Africa's economy to make life livable for all its citizens. New political parties, we will say, have emerged to give political energy to imagined visions informed by a new awareness. We have reconceptualized asset ownership and the accretion of its value, and we have, even in the process, confronted capitalism's illusion of the absolute autonomy of the individual, that millions and billions and trillions of rands, dollars, and euros owned by few individuals and few nations, including them, quantums of appropriated global and local social value, and that real estate purportedly owned by them can never, in the scheme of human evolution, be theirs entirely. So perhaps with this festival, celebrating 20 years of democracy in South Africa, Berliners and Sowetans will begin a new journey of sharing the world, not seeking to own it. Soweto, in this context, may very well be the new mother city of South Africa. On that day in Berlin, we may even meet in the Chancellor's Palace with a huge 16-foot-high maps of Germany and South Africa on the walls to share the stories of how we have successfully remade ourselves as a people. Thank you. Thank you.
Zabulo Ndebe, ich bin sehr froh. Mr. Ndebele, I'm very happy to welcome you, and I'm very happy to have you here as the keynote speaker opening our conference dealing with 20 years of democracy in South Africa. And I'm grateful not only because of your inspiring speech, but also because you moved back and forth between Sandton and Soweto, and thus you adopted different perspectives. And there was an important aspect you've mentioned too, that's Berlin and the entanglement, the involvement of Berlin and its role in the colonial history. We here tend to forget the role Berlin played, the country, the city played, colonial powers, we say, were France and the UK. And as it's even more interesting that at the end of your speech, you get back to Berlin and you talk about present times. And you mention or insinuate a vision, a utopia maybe even, which in the 21st century seems to be a rather remote one. Because in the 21st century, we have been dealing with late capitalism or new capitalism, and there are many processes of exclusion between rich and poor, between the south and the north of the world. And all of a sudden, you speak about the humanization of capitalism, of the human face, or a capitalism with a human face, which could be realized by both peoples. And that's why I would like to ask you, how come that you have, that you cherish this hope? Why do you have this hope? Why can you argue on the basis of the idea of another future?
Well, I think it's not difficult to understand why, because I have an inherent understanding that the problems that we have inherited today have had many centuries of being established, and their effects on many people, even in South Africa, they continue. So the way to deal with them impacts decisively on the solutions that you choose. So you can choose to work within the system and try to make it better. And we know that is not possible, because what Thomas Piketty's book shows is that if capital has accumulated for so much over many centuries, it's difficult to transfer the benefits, you know, either way. And so you need to try to think outside of it in a manner that can undermine it more fundamentally, but also that it is a romantic thinking to think that you can do that overnight. But it suggests that any political parties that arise in South Africa today have to have a long-term view of the future and know in very defined, specific ways how to embark on a process to dismantle the system. It took, in our specific conditions, more than 100 years to do so. We cannot undo within a shorter space of time. Maybe we can, but the point I'm trying to make is that the terrain of engaging it has got to be different. And so my insistence on that to continuing to use race as the factor of change, you're fighting the wrong battle. You've got to depend on what your understanding is of what your people have achieved over that century, despite the conditions in which they live. So to push aside racism is not to say it's not important. It's not the primary goal, it is secondary. And putting it in that relationship means you keep it in your eyes, but you focus on something much more fundamental.
Bin mir sicher, dass viele der Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer heute Abend.
Thank you very much. That's a really good point. But I think many listeners tonight in the audience were taken by surprise that racism takes a subordinate role for the future of the country. Having said that, it's also a dream. It's a vision, isn't it? I dare say. And let me just double check, because I found it so intriguing. You have many dichotomies in your presentation, like short-term and long-term, or partial interests and collective endeavors and plights. And last but not least, also dream and reality. So you have all these dichotomies, all of these opposites. So what do you think does this do? I mean, the dream, in how far can it fuel our future? On the other hand, you gave us a very tangible example, a lady who adopts a very pragmatic approach and sells her house in the township or builds a house in the township, doesn't stay in the suburbs. So this is a very down-to-earth vision, and it's not so dreamy, so it's a very pragmatic approach. So my question to you is, in political life, dream and reality, in how far do they have a relationship?
From Sentin to Soweto is not only a physical one that you people move back. It's also a conceptual journey. And I'll give you another example of what I mean about the debilitating factor of dormitory township life. Mm-hmm. Over a long period of time. Not too long ago, the South Africans were very excited discussing the new rapid bus transit system that will take people from Soweto to the city center in the quickest possible time. Mm-hmm. Now, technologically, and from the point of view of town planning, maybe it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. But what it really did from the perspective that I'm exploring this evening with you is that if the township is built structurally to export its labor, what this new system does, despite all the nice things, is to make the transporting of this labor faster. It doesn't change the system. Mm-hmm. So people keep going there, you know, faster, and they keep exporting their labor, so every day. So the technology then is used to entrench something that was put in place a long time ago. So it merely achieves a technical form at a higher level. I think that is the fundamental thing. If that system continues, it means you've got 2 million people who have no hope whatsoever that their own environment mm-hmm. gives them everything that they want. That they will still have to travel, because you can't get rid of the towns and the cities of Johannesburg around South Africa. But you change the center of gravity of the thinking behind the economy. That is what you change fundamentally. And this idea is not, even in my own mind, particularly well developed. I was flying a kite, you know, and to get people thinking in another way. But I think it offers a great deal of potential if we were able to set aside time to explore what are the fullest implications of the historical fact that millions of people were forced to abandon their houses, their homes, lost their lands. They went to the cities and found one another and developed a new life. That life has yet to feature centrally in the business of state.
Ich glaube, dass diese Frage, den Raum zu besetzen und mit welchen Perspektiven.
I think shaping space urban planning and the kind of the parcellation took place is something that where we now understand that this is not innocent. It was always fueled by a political concept, and this becomes very clear if you look at the townships and the emergence of the space in the townships. In Berlin, for instance, in the 1970s up until the 1980s, there were very strong attempts to change the space, the public space, by squatting, for instance, by just occupying houses and not moving anymore, paying any rent, etc. But the community, the coexistence, the communal living cannot be imposed top down by any kind of action. And this brings me to the final question. The first ones are already leaving the room because there's a concert waiting. But I mean, is there a link? Similar like the reconciliation project by Mandela, is there a special South African way how you can set up a meaningful citizenship? This is the language which you used in various contexts, and how you can create a community.
Special way, it is already in our constitution, and a lot of it is there. Take the issue of language. We have 11 official languages prescribed in the constitution, and the country. The constitution states very clearly what are the responsibilities of each province in using the languages and in their area and developing them. So we've got an enabling constitution with a Bill of Rights and everything. And what is needed is a commitment to make the constitution work. But it is also, and this is the point of my address, is that we should also now refocus on those things in this experience of the vast majority of South Africans that have brought them together. In other words, the sense of the future cannot happen outside of the solidarities that developed in the mines and industries of South Africa for over decades. And that is where we've got to explore what are the full implications of this. And secondly, that in fact, the structural complications are so urgent that in fact, the poor of South Africa still today are paying heavily for their poverty because of the way the system, the country is built. I think that we've got the enabling instruments. We must focus on the historically embedded value chain that has not been the center of our of national life, but needs to be brought in.
Es gibt natürlich immer eine Differenz zwischen so etwas wie.
Well, there's still always a gap between, you know, what constitutional can do and the reality of a expectation of a constitution. But I do share your hope. I do share your hope that this divide will be bridged and find that there will be a rapprochement. Final question to you, Professor. 20 years, is that a lot or isn't it a lot? Is 20 years long of time or are they a short period?
It's not a lot of time, but it's a long, long time in rethinking. There are many people in South Africa today who behave radically different from their behavior 20 years ago. And for all of us, there's not a single South African who has not traveled a very long journey, you know, in 20 years. And we are proud of what we have achieved, and we just need to look forward to doing more and building, making this country an important, to continue to be an important one in the imagination of the world of what it is possible to make out of human society.
Djabulo Nedebile. Ich danke Ihnen ganz herzlich. Ich danke Ihnen. Da oben hinter den Glasscheiben sitzen noch zwei Damen, nämlich Astrid Gese und Tanja Barbirien. Ohne die hätten wir das hier nicht machen können. Ihnen auch vielen Dank für die Übersetzung. Und dann möchte ich Sie alle.
And I would like to remind all of you that there is a wine reception downstairs, down the stairs, and you're kindly invited. So, see you there.